Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, this report. Higher education in the United States has never been more costly. The College Board is an independent organization that supports the growth of higher education in the U.S. It says that the average cost to attend a public four-year American college or university has increased more than 300% in the last 30 years. Most American colleges and universities do offer some form of financial assistance to their students. However, not all schools offer aid in the same way, and not all students are able to receive the same kind of aid, says Lutfi Jarari. He is the Associate Dean of Academic Life and Director of International Recruitment at DePauw University, a private liberal arts college in Indiana.
Jarari says there are several types of financial assistance that colleges and universities offer students. There is aid that schools award to students with strong academic records. Schools also give special awards to students who are especially skilled at a sport, musical instrument, or other activity. Jarari says the financial aid process can be complex, no matter what kind of assistance a student is seeking. It demands just as much attention as any other part of the college application process. Students should consider several things before sending in any aid application materials, Jarari says. For example, there are two main types of colleges and universities in the United States, public and private. Public universities are controlled by the states in which they are located. Private schools are independently operated.
What does this mean in terms of applying for financial aid? For both domestic and international students, Jarari says, there is a world of difference. He should know. He was once an international student himself. Born in Morocco, Jarari attended 1 year of college in his home country before finishing his higher education at Southern Illinois University, a public research university. He says most public American universities do not offer any financial aid to international students. That is because those schools have special responsibilities to students living in state. State universities have to serve the needs of the students in the state and the students in the U.S. first and foremost, Jarari told VOA. They are, of course, very, very open to having international students. But they are not able to give financial aid because they just don't have that for international students. Private universities don't have to follow everything that is dictated by the states. So, Jarari says, the first step for domestic and international students should be to ask what a school offers. He suggests contacting schools' financial aid offices directly.
Applicants can get answers to questions they may have about the school's financial aid availability. Jarari also notes that financial aid offices and admissions offices often work together. Anytime an applicant contacts and communicates with the school directly, the school sees it as a good sign. When they ask questions, we give them points, Jirari said. That is a sign that the student cares about the university, and for us, we use those points to decide admission and also to decide scholarships. Jirari says that students usually apply for financial aid from a university at the same time that they apply for admission. This is typically in the fall term of their final year of high school. American citizens can apply for financial aid from both the U.S. government and their college or university of choice. They do so by completing a free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA.
International students must apply for financial aid through one of two other methods. They can use the College Board's College Scholarship Service, or CSS, profile. They can also use the International Student Financial Aid application. Almost all U.S. colleges and universities use at least one of these methods to determine how much aid they will give to students, Jirari says. The main difference between the two is that the CSS profile costs about $25 for the first school students apply to and about $16 for each additional school. The International Student Financial Aid application is free. But Jirari says that neither method is necessarily better than the other. He says that the FAFSA, the CSS profile, and the International Student Financial Aid application all ask for the same kind of information. That information includes detailed proof of how much money, property, and other assets a student's family possesses. They also ask students to report the number of siblings a student has so schools know if their family is supporting more than one college student. Jirari notes that completing these application materials correctly is very important. For example, students must make sure that all their family's financial information is reported using the value in American dollars. Otherwise, the student risks making it appear that their family is wealthier than they actually are.
Also, he says, students must make sure all the documents they provide the school match the ones they use in their visa application. If a student does not tell the full truth on every part of their application, the school can and will find out. That can create serious problems. I've seen so many instances for both domestic and international students where students might try to hide an asset, thinking they will get more scholarship, he said. But what that causes is for us to see that the student is being untruthful. And in a lot of instances, we will deny that student.
In the end, schools do not want money to be a barrier to getting an education. They will give as much aid as they feel is reasonable, Jirari says. But students must fully understand how much a college or university costs. He notes that some schools only list their basic costs of attending classes on their websites without including other costs, such as housing. That is another reason why students should ask financial aid officers questions during every step of the process. The student can then compare how much a college or university truly costs to how much aid they are offering. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Hello, and welcome to the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Everyone around the world celebrates the New Year differently and at different times. Most people in the U.S. celebrate it on January 1st. But they may also observe New Year traditions from other religions or cultures. For example, many Asian cultures celebrate the Lunar New Year. This date changes from year to year. The date of the Islamic New Year also changes from year to year. And in India, each religious group has its own date for the beginning of the year. For example, the Hindu New Year comes in April or May. No matter when you celebrate the New Year, it usually involves thinking about the past year and planning for the year ahead. People have many different ways of ringing out the old and ringing in the new. But why are bells linked to the calendar change? In the Christian and Buddhist religions, bells are often connected with the new year. The website CatholicCulture.org explains that bells serve as a beautiful symbol introducing a new year to be spent together as a community of families. Another website describes how bells are used in Japan on New Year's Eve. As midnight approaches, Buddhist temples around the country begin ringing out the old year, sounding the temple bell 108 times. Each ring of the bell stands for each of the earthly desires a Buddhist must try to overcome, all 108 of them. Even those who aren't religious but are a little superstitious may ring bells at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve to scare off bad luck. These age-old traditions have given us the phrase to ring out the old and ring in the new. The English poet Alfred Lord Tennyson made the phrase popular with his poem In Memoriam, Ring Out Wild Bells. In this poem, Tennyson rings out, or says farewell, to the bad, and he rings in, or says hello, to the good. Tennyson wrote this poem for Arthur Henry Hallam. The two students met at Cambridge University and quickly became best friends, both showing great promise as writers. Hallam helped Tennyson publish volumes of his poetry in 1830 and 1832. The friends almost became family when Hallam became engaged to the poet's sister, Emily. However, before they could wed, Hallam died of a brain hemorrhage. He was only 22 years old. To remember his good friend, Tennyson wrote the poem In Memoriam. He also named one of his two sons, Hallam. Here is Jonathan Evans reading the first part of that poem.
Ring out wild bells to the wild sky. The flying cloud, the frosty light, the year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring, happy bells, across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind. For those that here we see no more, ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws.
Thanks, Jonathan. And thank you, our listeners, for the time you have spent reading and listening to Words and Their Stories these past 12 months. We here at VOA Learning English wish all of you a happy start to the new year. I'm Ana Mateo.
All of those who are hither and yonder, With love in our hearts, we grow fonder and fonder. Hail to those who we hold so dear, and hail to those who are gathered here. And
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter, and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about. But, he says, other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819. His sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it. And Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. "For Mr. Jackson's sake," she said, "I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it." Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. "I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God," she said, "than to dwell in that palace in Washington." She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.